I wanted to invite you to comment on an intrigue based on your own work in the area. And this relates to three things. It relates to the Kennedy assassination, the weapons used, the Roswell incident, and the general idea of space weapons.
Okay.
So here's how we go. So, and Roswell itself is a location. And also there's a double or two in there too.
All right.
So I found out, and I did an episode recently called Roswell Reignited. And the reason it's reignited is because I came across information that the officer that found the weapon, which he first identified as a 7.65 Mauser in the Texas School Book Depository, Eugene Boone, 24-year-old deputy sheriff, he went in there, and that was his first affidavit that he put in there. And
the Mauser.
Yes, the Mauser, 7.65. And, of course, we know that Roger Craig and then Seymour Weitzman. So three of the first respondents, that's what they reported.
Right.
And in Craig's case, he said, but, you know, they all were like, oh, it's 7.65.
Mauser.
Right. Yeah, it's actually printed
stamped on the barrel or some part of the gun.
Barrel, exactly. Yeah. The other thing is that there is a one of those runs a gun store. I think it's Weitzman.
I think it was Weitzman.
Yeah. He would know. Yeah.
Right.
So we have the weapon piece. Now, Boone, when I went into his history, Boone is somebody who would leave the police department and go to run the foster children's homes in Texas for the same Fosters that owned the Roswell Ranch.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. And that's on the record now because I've done the research and put it out there.
Holy cow.
So this guy is running. He becomes the CEO of the foster homes. And the Fosters, who own not only these cattle ranches, but a lot of big oil there in Texas, they face a situation when the Roswell crash happens, which is, when they go up there, the first thing that happens is Mac Brazel, who's their ranch hand. He runs the ranch, but he doesn't own it. And he calls him up and says, you got problems. And people witness that call. Fosters come up. They get their talking to. And supposedly the talking to goes something like this. We want the ranch. We need it all. Sell it to us because of this incident. And they originally refuse. And then little by little, they're bought off with mineral rights. And I've also heard a gold mine. But the mineral rights is something that's sort of cascading through the literature. And they become incredibly well off. I mean, they were already doing quite well.
Right.
And then they become, you know, and they run, they're part of the
Campbell.
Yes, Frederick Price.
Campbell.
And they're the ones, the only, you know, one way to identify them is they don't allow instruments in the church.
I know who they are.
Very interesting group. And all of the people who work for the Fosters are members.
Right. Okay.
So that gives them, I guess, kind of a good network there. And so by the time we get our friend Boone there running everything, you know, we've got this situation where the Fosters don't ever talk about the incident again. However, later on in the literature, like the grandkids talked a little bit about how transformed the grandparents were by the whole thing. So we have some of those things on the record, in fact. And a lot of unusual things happen in terms of Brazel's family. Like one of his kids disappear. He goes to Alaska. He gets out of there. And one of his kids disappears. And then that's it. It's a missing person. Oddly enough, 30 years later, turns out that he just went to Montana and changed his identity and died there. A suicide. So there's a lot of weird things around the incident that weren't really, you know, it's hard to connect what those dots are. Now, there's the whole book that this Major Vinson put out, who was an Air Force major, and he wrote something about being going into Dallas, and he went there. He was getting this whole transport back to Colorado Springs, and he worked at NORAD. And he gets on this plane. And he's asking, what plane can I use? And they give him this weird plane to get on. It's a C-54, and the logo is an egg. And it looks like the Earth is an egg shape with these grids through it. So long story short, what happens is while he's on the plane, someone gets on the plane who looks exactly like Oswald, along with the tall Cuban.
Now, wait a minute. He's flying from Dallas to NORAD?
To Colorado Springs. That's where NORAD was at the time. Yeah. So he takes this move and he gets on. And he came from Andrews. Uh-huh. So he went from Andrews. He was heading to Colorado Springs. And what happens is when he gets on at Andrews, he gets on and it's this weird plane with a logo. And so the plane is taking him from Andrews in D.C. all the way to Colorado Springs. Uh-huh. But about 12:29, a voiceover comes up and says, "We're diverting. The president has just been shot." And they turn the plane around and it lands near the Trinity River. Now, when it lands in this unexpected landing, he's the only person on the plane except for the pilot and co-pilot, by the way, and they don't say anything to him when they get on. So the plane lands and two people get on. One of them is in construction overalls and the other one is similarly dressed. One is a tall Cuban and the other one, according to this guy, is Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, he's very confused by the situation.
Yeah.
And when they get on, they don't say anything to him. They go right up to the cockpit. And then the plane goes into the air, and he's like, "Where are we even going?" And so it lands, and they run out, these two, the Oswald double and this Cuban. They literally go right past him. The pilots go right past him and don't say anything. And he's just sitting there on this plane. So he gets out, and he looks for some person to talk to. And there's an MP in a little office with a light. Uh-huh. He goes in there and he said it was dusk. And he said, "Where am I?" And the guy said, "You're in Roswell Air Force Base." Oh, and he said, "Well, weird. I'm supposed to go to Colorado Springs." He said, "Well, you're not getting anywhere. All these bases have been locked down because of the assassination. So you're going to have to just hang out." And he does. And eventually he gets a bus to go to another location and the bus takes him up to Colorado Springs. That's his story, and he kept it for years and years.
Oh,
he tried to give it to the Assassination Record Review Board.
They wouldn't take it?
They wouldn't take it because of the Roswell mention.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Wow. So here's a double. Here's a Roswell connection after the assassination, and there's Boone in the middle of all this, finding the rifle, and he works for the Foster Ranch people.
You don't make up a story like this.
No. No. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is.
So with, you know, and I've put my take about Roswell and everything else, but I know what you have about Roswell and the Reich. I've spent many hours with your book. Uh-huh. If you combine all these circumstances, what are you getting out of those peculiar connections?
Well, number one, that they're taking such pains to buy the Foster Ranch and essentially silence them.
Yes.
What that tells me, I mean, that area of New Mexico, I don't know if you've ever been to it, but that area of New Mexico is a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah. I've been to Albuquerque and Santa Fe, but this is further over.
I mean, this is a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah.
It's just, so to go to those lengths tells me that one of the things that possibly it indicates is that the crash site itself was very large.
Yes.
Not, you know, not the little contained thing that most, mm-hmm. most people have in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's number one. Number two, the other thing it tells me is that there's something extremely odd either about it. Maybe they did find strange bodies. Who knows? You know, I'm not a believer in the bodies narrative, but for various reasons, not the least of which is they can't get the story to come down to an agreed data set. But whatever it was that they're finding or that was found there, they're worried that something else might still be there. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And then the part of the thing that mystifies me is if you've got a soldier working at NORAD who is on a flight from D.C. to Colorado Springs. They divert to Dallas. They pick up Lee Harvey Oswald double and then fly on to Roswell.
Yeah.
What that's suggesting to me is that somehow that base and the whole story connected with it is part of this whole Kennedy assassination story in some fashion.
Yes.
That has never been adequately disclosed or investigated.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes to the basic thesis in Roswell and the Reich that it had something to do with advanced space or aeronautic technology.
Right.
And it may have had something to do with nuclear weapons as well, since that was a nuclear weapons base as well. But that's just very bizarre and weird. All the weirdness around both Roswell and Kennedy, that's just plain weird.
It's interesting because, you know, it's kind of a weird addendum to the whole thing. Vincent goes on the year.
No,
later,
I don't think it's. No, hang on, just a minute. I wouldn't qualify it as an addendum. I think it's a central issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's an indicator that there's much more here than meets the eye, and you know this. Yes. These are little tidbits.
Yes,
I don't. It's not an appendix.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major. My guess is it's a major chapter of the story.
Yes, absolutely.
What's interesting also about it is that if this is appearing in books that appeared in what 70 or 80, you showed it earlier. My question is, why didn't the so-called big names of Roswell research, Stanton Friedman and Kevin Randall and people like that.
Oh, yeah, the whole group.
Why did they miss it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's extraordinary. It's left out of all the Roswell literature.
Yeah.
And it's not celebrated in the JFK literature because
it includes I didn't know anything about it. And again, you know, I've never encountered the story either in Roswell connection or in JFK connection. So my question really is then why was it missed? Back at that time, you would have had, you know, various guides, analog guides that could have summarized literature on these things.
Mm-hmm.
So why was it missed? Was it not cataloged? Was it not entered into Reader's Guide of Periodical Literature and so on and so forth? Did no one ever review it?
Mm-hmm.
That raises a lot of questions.
It's pushed out of the literature on both sides.
Yeah.
And it's not accepted by the official body of the ARRB. They don't want it. Even with the guy's impeccable background, you know. And he went on, by the way, to be recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency to work at Area 51.
Hey, he's good stuff for us, but not for you guys. No, you're on to something here. There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, I've been around research like of this sort for long enough to know when you're on to something and when you're not, and you're definitely on to something.
Wow, fascinating. The Foster Ranch.
Yeah, that
connection, so unusual.
Yeah, they don't just come in and buy a whole ranch, a lot of nothing. They're my guess is that they probably ran more post Roswell incident cleaning missions. In other words, they went back in, they sent other teams back in after all the attention had died down to find any other debris that might have been left by those initial debris cleaning missions.
Right.
It would not surprise me a bit.
Do you think that that is fascinating? You know, an intrepid little Roswell researcher found out about the ranch, that the status of the ranch in 1948 got changed to a toxic level where you couldn't raise animals on it and you couldn't raise different types of crops on it because of the toxic identification that it had.
In 48?
In 48, a year later.
Yeah. But they don't specify what the toxicity was?
No. No, but you know, it's interesting because it's that same level that you would get, you know, if a, like a toxic spill had happened, something major had occurred there. And so for the people who would own it in perpetuity, and it switched around in quite a few hands, oddly enough, all those people couldn't grow, you know, plants on it, couldn't grow crops on it, and couldn't herd sheep.
Well, any look at that again. That area of New Mexico is not known for a lot of crop growing. I mean, it's at best scrub. So, in other words, what they're really saying is, don't let any of your animals eat any of these plants, and don't eat any of your animals that do eat these plants.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they're buying the ranch because it's a toxic spill.
Yes.
So that means whatever caused the toxic spill was caused by the crash.
Exactly.
And something found in it. And right off the top of my head, I can think of lots of stuff that might be found in Nazi technology that you wouldn't want your animals eating. Things like thorium oxide, mercury thorium oxide, mm-hmm. probably not the best thing to ingest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can think of a lot of
highly toxic.
Very.
Huh. Yeah.
Very. And you wouldn't want animals exposed to it. So yeah, that whole thing gives the exotic technology twist to the whole thing another little bit of loose confirmation.
Well, we always knew because of Marcel, uh-huh. because of the character of Marcel, uh-huh. that it was not a mistake on his part.
No.
And that nonsense, the cover story, is as bad as the Lone Gunman cover story in history.
Yeah.
That's one. But then two, we also knew from all the strange things he described that it was something major and that he was familiar with all different types of aircraft.
Yeah.
Had been a pilot since 1928,
yeah.
in fact. So he would have been very familiar with it, and that he was also not only in charge of intelligence for the base, but security.
Yep.
So we're in a whole different ballgame there with Marcel when he comes upon it and his original description. Yeah. And of course, they make him give the phony explanation of a weather balloon at the news conference, and he has to button his lip. And the story hangs out for 32 years in complete silence.
Well, the story never made sense to me.
Yeah. And
by the way, I don't remember who it was, but in the photographs of General Ramey and Jesse Marcel with the so-called debris, there's a little folded up scrap of paper, the telegram. Have you heard about
that?
Someone blew it up and deciphered that whole
thing. Talks about a crash.
Yeah, and blew all that weather balloon nonsense.
Yeah.
Out of the water.
Wow. But
no, what the Army Air Force was asking us to believe was that they had an intelligence officer and chief of security at the country's only nuclear air base that was a complete ninny.
Right.
Okay, guys. You know,
that weather balloon.
That dog doesn't hunt.
Wow. And they still use weather balloons as the most ridiculous excuse. It's like a fallback position for a PSYOP. It's interesting, though.
Now the latest version of the balloon thing was the Mogul balloon.
Yes, right. That nonsense about Project Mogul. Oh, it was an experimental balloon. And guess what? We had these dummies, crash test dummies, that we would drop, you know.
No, after all their explanations, I'd sooner believe the dead lizards with the beaded skin and the three version of the incident than the military explanations of it, because they just make no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you think about what they're trying to fob off on the public, the more you really realize that it doesn't make any sense.
Well, one thing that Marcel said at the end of his life either supports your position on Roswell and the Reich about it being Nazi technology, and it may very well, or something else. So a college student hears about him, goes over there, and becomes friendly with her, and she's recording. She records 3 hours of his conversation.
Who's this and, her?
She was a college student named Linda Corley.
Actually, I just went through her entire transcript.
And she's recording an interview with Jesse Marcel.
Yes.
Okay.
Actual Jesse Marcel. I've heard the tape and I have the transcript.
Okay.
And it's very interesting because this is one of those things that got lost in the shuffle as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So she's going there and she's having him describe what the hieroglyphs actually look like. And it's quite interesting because the more he describes them, the more they look like odd, almost geometric shapes, mm-hmm. more so than hieroglyphs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she's doing this project with him. He's being very nice about things. And at the end of the conversation, she says, are there things that you've kept beyond what you've told? And he said, of course. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, I swore an oath to secrecy for my country. I could never let those things out.
Oh, sure.
So that's where we end up with Jesse Marcel, that yes, I can tell you about the crash. Yes, I can tell you about the hieroglyphs and the memory metal and all the rest of it, but I can't tell you about the other thing.
Right.
So the other thing, it sounds like he knew what the other thing was.
It was, right.
Yeah. Sure. So here's the odd thing. After she gathers up her information, she goes back home and she makes a call to him and says, you know, that those images are interesting. I almost think it's like some kind of Roman language or something, but I'll get back to you because I'm working on this. And then he calls her up and says, forget everything that I said. You know, don't share it with the public. I don't want you to put any of that on the record. Forget all about it and like wow. move on with your life and forget it. And he never spoke to her again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he died shortly after that. But what do you make of that?
Well, it sounds to me like he either had profound second thoughts about making the descriptions of the hieroglyphs that he did in the interview, or that he was literally threatened and told to warn her not to release it.
Yeah. Maybe they were tapping his apartment.
Well, I would be a bit surprised.
Yeah.
The hieroglyphs part of the story, he actually, and I have this in the Roswell and the Reich book, he actually underwent a hypnotic regression session at some point. I forget exactly when.
His son did.
His son did. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Marcel Jr.
It was Marcel Jr. It was asked to draw what he had seen on those so-called I-beams in terms of the hieroglyphics. And he drew a bunch of things under hypnosis that looked very geometric in character, not hieroglyphs, but just geometric things. And what struck me when I looked at his drawing was that, and again, I have this in the Roswell book, was that some of these things that he drew looked like quantum states of the hydrogen atom. And I put pictures of these quantum states of the hydrogen atom so that you can compare what he's drawing with these quantum states. Which is an interesting, you know, it's a possibility. It's an interesting speculation. So I've never, you know, the details of the whole Roswell story are what has always inclined me that you're really looking at some sort of exotic technology, and that's what they're really trying to keep hushed up for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I think is interesting about the hieroglyph story is that in saucers, swastikas, and psyops, I also point out that some of these early UFO stories where people are contacted by visitors, the visitors are always Nordic.
And oh, yeah.
In some of these stories, there's a famous case of a UFO contact story that occurred in, I think it was 1954 or 55, outside of Kearney, Nebraska. And, you know, which is on the Platte River. And this individual, I forget what his name was, I think it's Schmidt, who was, you know, typical Upper Plains German. You know, I grew up in South Dakota, so I know these people. They speak German. So my organ teacher, you know, spoke German until he was 5 years old. Oh, so, wow. You know, they exist. And it's not like the Goering family in the Black Hills, but anyway.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's a whoa. But anyway, I actually had a shop teacher, Daniel, in the eighth grade that was named Goering. And his German accent was
in the land. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, his German accent was very thick too. So we all, the nickname that we had for him was Der Reichsmarschall. But anyway, in this incident in Kearney, this man was contacted and taken up, supposedly alleges he was taken up in this ship where they were speaking German.
Oh,
which was a very weird UFO story.
Yeah. And
the thing that convinces me that there had to have been some sort of kernel of truth in it is that, you know, this is one of those stories you can make up and sell to Fate magazine back then. You know, so it doesn't deserve any credence on its own. But the interesting thing about the story is that he elaborated and went on to say that the FBI and the Air Force had sent these people out to Kearney from Omaha, you know, SAC base there at Omaha, to interview him. And they got there within a time frame that indicates that they were expecting something to happen. In other words, they left Omaha. Kearney to Omaha is a pretty fair little drive. So there's something there, you know. So I have to wonder about these stories about hieroglyphs and people hearing languages and so on. I don't doubt them. I just wish that there was more to go on with
respect. Interesting. We have hieroglyphs in the Kecksburg case.
Yeah, hieroglyphs in the Kecksburg case, yes.
It's pretty interesting also when you think about it, because the Betty and Barney Hill story includes a Nazi uniform. That one of the people appears to Barney to be wearing a Nazi uniform.
Nazi uniform. And again, why, you know, that's a very strange thing to notice, much less say.
I mean, it's on his hypnosis tape.
It's on his hypnosis tape, yeah. Yeah, it's a very, very strange thing to say. So there's there's always been an aspect of ufology that wants to ignore those stories, and I find it very disconcerting that, you know, if you're gonna accept other contactee and abduction cases, you've got to look at these and those details. It's just more proof that, as far as I'm concerned, that you, whenever you're talking about the phenomenon of the UFO, you're not dealing with one phenomenon. You're dealing with a whole continuum of different discrete types of phenomena, and they're all just equally baffling.
Wow.
Yeah. So who knows where this is going to end up? What you're uncovering with this Foster Ranch business and the pilot and the Oswald double, that's not an appendix.
Mm-hmm.
That's somehow a central part of this story that no one's noticed before.
Unbelievable.
In my opinion.
Yeah, you can feel it.
You can feel it.
As soon as Boone came up, connected mm-hmm. with Roswell, I said, it can't be right. But it's absolutely right. He was the CEO.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you another interesting thing to just kind of the cherry on top is, guess what was reported to happen while Boone was CEO there?
What?
Two of the girls who lived in the foster homes experienced an alien abduction.
Oh, I can believe that. I was about to say, the fact that he's connected with children's homes is in my mind, very much a part of the story and very suspicious.
Yeah.
It suggests to me that there's an aspect of human experimentation going on with that end of the story that dovetails perfectly with the other end of the story,
mm-hmm.
which I talk about in the LBJ book with Alton Ochsner and the cancer clinic that he was running in New Orleans, and Dr. Mary Sherman, and the fact that Dr. Ochsner, you know, fellow South Dakotan, by the way, folks, would often go down to Latin America to treat his famous cancer patients down there, one of whom was Juan Perón.
Perón, forget it.
And the other thing that I highly suspect is he had something to do with all of that secret cancer research and may have been in contact with Mengele in Brazil.
Oh, right.
There's your human children part of the, because you've got all those strange twins in Brazil in these Indian tribes out in the middle
of those cases are unbelievable.
They're unbelievable.
That's Mengele at work.
Absolutely. So there's perhaps some tie in there with what's going on in New Orleans with Dr. Sherman and Dr. Ochsner, with this foster ranch children. There's this, to be honest with you, this gives me the creeps because this is, this is something major.
Well, it's opening the transhumanism aspect. And then there's this ET overlay piece. There's a UFO file overlay, but we don't know if that's somebody kind of manipulating the picture.
Well, you've even got Nick Redfern's, book Body Snatchers in the Desert, I think is the title.
Oh yeah.
Strange little book, but it's very interesting because he maintains that his contacts were telling him about all these bodies that, you know, including the Roswell crash, that were children that were afflicted with progeria disease, rapid aging disease. Which again, you know, it's a strange thing to run across in connection with Roswell. But again, it ties in with this theme of children or somehow, you know, what in the name of sense are they doing out there?
Wow.
You know,
incredible.
And let's not forget another grisly aspect of that was Japanese Unit 731. On the other side of World War II, they were experimenting with progeria. So there's
giving Mengele a run for his money.
The Japanese were certainly giving Mengele a run for his money.
Yeah, we don't hear much about that.
No, we don't. In fact, I'm only aware of one major book on Unit 731. I have a copy of it, but it's just, you know, it's one of those books you have to read and just little bits at a time because it really is monstrous.
You know, what's interesting about all this is when I think about something that you told me in relation to the Kennedy assassination was that Ruby, you felt, was one of the most interesting characters of all.
Yes.
And it's interesting to note that Boone, before he's the 24-year-old guy finding the gun in the school book depository, he is an ad executive 2 years earlier, and his client that he hangs out with and parties with everywhere is Jack Ruby.
Oh, you're kidding.
So, instantly, when I saw that.
Executive at the age of 22?
Yeah.
In Dallas?
Yeah. Give me that one.
Well,
this guy gets placed everywhere.
Yeah, I was about to say, I call that a legend, not talent. Unreal.
Well, it's interesting because the minute I saw that, I said, you know, you were right again, because here's Ruby hanging out with this guy who's associated with this whole thing. And, you know, that whole crisscross of the shadowy world that Ruby's in plays nicely into somebody like Boone. They knew where to place Ruby. They knew where to place Boone.
Ruby has so many connections that, you know, from Richard Nixon that Peter Dale Scott uncovered there wasn't anybody in any of that world that Ruby didn't seem to know or have something to do with.
Yes.
So, you know, the idea of him offing Oswald because he felt sorry for Mrs. Kennedy and wanted to be a patriotic American. I mean, come on.
Wow.
what bothers me more than anything else, Daniel, is here we are. It's 2025. It's, what, 60-plus years since the assassination. And you still have the occasional bow to the Warren Report.
Oh, yeah.
On the part of people in government. And no one that I can't think of anybody that I have met in my life that believes that.
Yes.
So they're maintaining this fiction to this day. And the question has to be why?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they maintaining it to this day? You know, they have tried to do that with the assassination of Lincoln, and they're not able to get away with it because that is in tatters. But for Kennedy, for some reason, it's still in play. And I have to conclude that it's for two reasons above all. It was his system of finance,
mm-hmm.
and it was the black projects and technology.
And the UFO file. In well, there.
Which would be the UFO file included in that.
Yes.
So yeah, that's the reason for it. Which really raises, you know, really raises the question of why is the playbook so similar then to Abraham Lincoln? Same motivations, same types of people, same system of finance. You know.
Wow.
This is a long-term game that we're looking at. And I increasingly think it's been a very long, 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 long term game. I can't come to any other conclusion.
Well, you can almost lay that grid.
Yes.
What you do in the book of Abraham Lincoln over the Kennedy assassination, and it plays out.
Yeah.
In that sense. And it's interesting what you said there about peace, of course, because Kennedy thought as a step to peace, I'll share the black projects. I'll share the UFO file. I'm going there with the Soviets. And they looked at him and said, wow.
Well, there's another aspect of this about Russia too, that will come out in the second book. But if you stop and think about it, this is what I find so very frustrating. This Russophobia and hatred of Russia has been going on in the West since the end of the Napoleonic Wars.
Incredible.
Since 1815.
Wow. Yeah.
And there, if you stop and think about the United States, if you just really think about America's geopolitical and national interest, there is very little of it that is in conflict with Russia.
Yes.
Even during the height of the Soviet era, there's very mm-hmm. little that is in actual open conflict with each other. So why the hostility?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are we trying to stir up the pot in the Ukraine because of Russia? What are we afraid of?
Yes.
They're not stirring up the pot with us.
Right, exactly. I mean, you get the Berlin Wall versus bombing their bombers.
Yeah.
You know, and those actions, the incredible escalation that we've seen in the Ukraine action against Russia. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's incredibly unhealthy as a political approach with a nuclear-armed nation in any case.
Yeah.
Not to mention all the other factors, but there's a kind of a process going on there, it seems like, where a group deep inside the intelligence faction feels like they can really move in and they can sort of call foreign policy regardless of who's president, whether it was Biden the puppet or Trump who's off on his own trip.
It bothers me because if Trump knew nothing about it, that's very worrying.
Yeah.
The other problem is that what it's saying is that Lindsey Graham, or as I like to call him, Lindsey Graham Cracker. And, well, the guy is a nut. He's over there in Kiev talking to his pal Zelensky as a day away from this operation taking place, and he doesn't have one visit, not one, to the hurricane victims in the Carolinas.
Wow. He's a warmonger extraordinaire.
He's a warmonger. It's all he knows, is hatred of Russia, and he's pals with a neo-Nazi, whatever he is, that's running the Ukraine.
Right.
So I don't get it. But the other thing is, if Trump did know and is lying, what does that say? Either way you slice what just happened in the Ukraine, it's bad.
Incredible.
What bothers me, Daniel, is Trump has his strengths, but history and culture and foreign policy aren't one.
Yeah.
So we're essentially in this national security situation where he's getting all of his Golden Dome stuff lined up.
Yeah.
But he's doing so in a way that bothers me. And that's, he's doing it in a geopolitical historical vacuum that he's not given us any indication of the geopolitical calculation that has gone into his thinking behind this thing, and its effect on our allies and its effect on our competitors.
Exactly.
You know, we have some pretty stiff competition out there now that we didn't have when he was growing up and formulating his views.
No question.
India, China, Japan, you know, these are all major space powers. And, you know, of the three of them, India is to me the most interesting because they can launch enormous amounts of satellites, which they've proven they can do, and do it quickly. Which, wow. If you stop and think about the management and administrative feat alone that it required them to do that a couple of years back, that's enormous.
Oh yeah.
So you know, we're doing this Golden Dome and we're doing all of this technology stuff, but we're not being told what are the geopolitical risks and calculations that you've made in reaching your decision. That's what, more than anything else, that's what bothers me about this.
Oh, the danger is weaponizing space.
Well, I think space is already weaponized and everybody tacitly knows.
Yeah.
But it's one thing to weaponize space and then to come out and proclaim that you're going to escalate it.
Yes.
That gives me pause. That gives me pause.
Oh, no question. Yeah, it's a dangerous project. What I'm curious about is the hidden reason for putting it on a fast track. And it seems to me it's the Star Wars 2 SDI reason,
which was never clear in the first place. You know, there's the Colonel Corso version of Star Wars that the real intention was UFO related, and I suspect that that's the case here. Yeah. I'm in the Catherine Fitz camp here. She and I have suspected for a long time, and for that matter, Richard Hoagland, you know, has for years given his own variation of the same idea.
Oh yeah,
that they know something. And they're in a rush. And they're not telling the rest of us. You know, yeah. Elon Musk is in a hurry to get to Mars. And my question is, why?
Yeah.
And it's not climate change.
Oh. Yeah.
So it just isn't. They're in a hurry. And I suspect it's that they, my own personal suspicion is that they are suspecting someone is coming. And they want to be ready for it.
It's a la Reagan with Gorbachev and Reykjavik in 87.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Reagan let the cat out of the bag, as he often did.
Mm-hmm.
And Gorbachev, too, by going along with it and not saying, oh, no, that's just stupid, you know, which he could have easily have done.
Yes.
But no, my reading of Gorbachev's reaction is, Oh, he wants to talk about that. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we know about that too.
Yeah. We might even know more than you guys
do. We might even know more than you guys do. Yeah, exactly. You know, his reaction is not one of surprise, and his reaction is not one of, oh, you old doddering fool from California. You know, no, it's not that at all. It's right. Okay. Well, I'll talk about that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're right there with you to fight the
aliens. Yeah, we're right there with you.
Here's an interesting thing. Apparently, Reagan talked a lot about the UFO file and put it in a lot of his speeches, but Colin Powell, his autobiography, if you read it, and I've quoted him from time to time on this, he said, the late Colin Powell, that he dedicated himself to taking out those UFO file alien references in Reagan's speeches, and he missed it when Reagan got to the UN and at a Maryland school, so that Reagan got this out twice, and over again, Powell is there, and Powell says, oh, I blame myself for it, sigh.
Yeah, I can believe it.
So, yeah. So Reagan was like, you know, I'm Americana. Americans can handle this. Let's put it out there. And he, in his kind of almost, I would say, fantasy patriotic mind, America can do everything, even fight the outsiders, you know?
Yep. Yeah. We're the shining city on the hill. We're the exceptional nation, the indispensable group of people. No one can live without us. And all the blessings that we shower in the form of bombs upon you. just, and again, you know, to me, that's that whole attitude is one of the big consequences of the war between the states when you get right down to it. But
anyway, yes,
the thing about Reagan and Colin Powell, I think Colin Powell was more or less selected to be his handler and manager on that score. In other words, I don't think that this was just a one-off that General Powell decided he was going to do to keep Reagan from embarrassing himself. No, he was, you're going to go make sure that he does not let any more of the cat out of the bag. Because Reagan, in his memoirs, to me, really lets the cat out of the bag.
Yeah.
With that little statement that he was, when he first took office, he was advised that our space lift capacity was over 300 people.
Oh, right.
Puts it right in his memoirs.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. Especially considering what, at the time we had, what, four or five space shuttles, and they can each take at best maybe 7 to 8 crew members for a total of 40.
Yes.
So where's the other 260 going?
Yeah, Challenger didn't have 300 people. I mean, come on.
Exactly.
That disaster that they had with them. And, you know, it's funny because the Challenger seems like the ultimate nail in the coffin for the Kennedy manned space program.
Right. Yeah. And here's another little tidbit that most people don't remember. Wernher von Braun.
Yeah.
When he was shown the plans for the space shuttle, Hoagland has mentioned this many, many times. When he was shown the plans for the space shuttle, he wept.
Oh, no.
Because he was so flabbergasted at how anything so shabby could come out of his beloved NASA.
Wow.
He thought it was
that's major.
Oh, yeah. He thought it was a complete farce.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
the man on the inside who would know.
The man on the inside who would know. And he actually, if I'm remembering the story correctly, von Braun pointed out that this was, would endanger the lives of the astronauts far beyond what was necessary. I mean, you know. So, yeah, Reagan knew something from whatever briefings that he was privy to about the whole topic. And I suspect that really began with his term as governor of California. And I know you have similar suspicions with Reagan and UFOs in California. So,
yeah.
So it's not surprising to me. that this.
They say he first got the idea for SDI in 74, attending a Teller lecture.
Oh, I can believe it.
Yeah.
I can believe it. Let's face it. If there was an idea for Star Wars, Teller probably came up with it. Or someone, yes. DARPA. I mean, Reagan dreaming this up on his own. Yeah, he's capable of doing it, but he would never have come out and given a speech like that without the military industrial complex behind it in some way.
Absolutely. Never. Yeah.
Never.
Incredible. Yeah. Joseph, this has just been remarkable. And the books, of course, as a set, are going to change how we look at the Civil War and all that piece. I mentioned to you before we started that I've been seeing a lot of podcasts and things pick up on your work, and I have to say it outright, plagiarize it, which you're seeing a kind of epidemic of plagiarizing. I thought it would be good for all those podcast pop clickers to hear your opinion on Bob Lazar.
On Bob Lazar?
These people don't understand the background, and they do this whole thing with Lazar where they're like, oh, he got all these secrets out, and they buy the whole thing hook, line, and sinker.
No, I've never bought Bob Lazar, and I don't know what this has to do with the shows that you're talking about that are plagiarizing me, or, you know, I've noticed the same thing, quite frankly. It's very discouraging to me.
Yeah.
But with Bob Lazar, and I pointed this out, I forget in which book, quite frankly. But with Bob Lazar, my problem with his story has always been his statements regarding element 115 or element Unum Pentium, as the name of the element goes.
Yes.
Which is one of these transuranic heavy elements that have been in recent years synthesized in various particle accelerators and so on and so forth. The German Particle Institute at Darmstadt has successfully synthesized element 115. When Lazar made his claims, that German particle accelerator had not yet synthesized it. And Lazar claims that he's been invited over to Darmstadt to cooperate with them on making, and he may have been. I'm not saying that he's not being truthful there. My problem is with what he has claimed about element 115 itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, you know, I have a big chemical physics reference book up here on the top shelf that does nothing but give you all, I mean, in copious amounts of detail that you could never possibly use. It gives you, you know, all this chemical, atomic, subatomic detail about each and every element in the periodic table. It's a book about that thick. It's about 4 inches thick, and it's big, you know. It's like a big dictionary. And if you look up element 115, Unum Pentium, the projected half-life for the element is, if I remember correctly, somewhere around 0.08 decimal points seconds long. So in other words, it's not there for very long before it decays into something else.
Mm-hmm.
When you investigate Lazar's story, he will tell you, and John Lear will back this up, that he and John Lear managed to collect a little bit of element 115 and take it to their home and store it.
Yes.
For a period of, well, I'm sorry. You wouldn't even be able to blink fast enough. The element would decay faster than you can blink, much right. less getting it collected into an amalgamated pile that you can handle, which you wouldn't want to do, and then take home.
Right.
That part of the story, I'm sorry, not buying it.
All right. That part's a very sketchy narrative. As is the brothel thing and the line about the education.
Of that stuff. I'm sorry. We really desperately need to develop a serious mentality in ufology. This is why I avoid ufology. I just can't stand stuff like that. You know, and what bothers me is it's a story that anybody can check by going to that reference.
Yes.
And just think a little bit, you know, just a teeny tiny little bit, just think. And then, you know, there's this business that they use element 115 in their anti-gravity sports model flying saucer. And I have listened to his presentation on that, and I can't for the life of me figure out what he's talking about and why element 115 is necessary. Because essentially he's talking about these beams that project a column of energy, and that creates the anti-gravity effect. Well, folks, that's a well-known phenomenon in physics. It's called the soliton effect, and it's using microwaves, okay?
Tell it like it is, right?
Tell it like it is. You know, Dr. LaViolette wrote a wonderful book called Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, and he talks about the soliton effect and so on and so forth. Nothing new, nothing really that fancy. And wow. We all know what a soliton is. I mean, you know, you've got solenoids in your cars, similar thing, you know.
Something very scripted about that whole release back in the day. And for many of these things with the podcasters and the PubClick thing, they keep going back to Lazarus' thing. They don't examine the education lies. They don't examine the brothel stuff. They don't examine the Element 115 stories. They don't examine what seems to be very limited access to anything.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, you know, if I don't know who out there is saying that is if they're referring to me in connection with Bob Lazar or not. But if they would do the homework, they would know that I've just never been a fan. And that's why you don't hear me talking about him all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I thought that was kind of a good straight up litmus test. Like, yeah, have you done the background on Bob Lazar? Let's start there. Right?
Start with the story, folks. Does the story make sense? And
yes.
The answer is no, it does not.
Well, we know that they're listening, so. You just delivered the message.
Well, I hope they are. You know, Daniel, you mentioned these shows that are talking about me. There's somebody out there, I forget the name of the guy, that's had different people on on his podcast.
Yes,
and he's apparently asking them about me. Well, you know, dude. They're on your show. Talk to them about the things that they're on your show for. And if you want to talk to me, email, you know.
That's a little awkward, isn't it?
That's a little awkward. I mean, come on.
So what do you really know about like Joseph Carroll? Inviting
me on, yeah, you invite me on and you want me to talk about Phyllis Diller. I mean, you know, it just makes no sense.
Oh, Phyllis Diller, that's a whole episode. We'd have to do an episode.
I don't know why I pull her in out of the ether, but she was just there, so come on, Phyllis. You know, she was actually a very good classical pianist. Did you know that?
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
she was. Wow.
She's very good.
Well, I'll tell you this. Here's my takeaway from that stuff, which is these people.
Phyllis Diller or these people. Go ahead.
They're basically Phyllis Diller, too. these people are under pressure for content and don't take the time to research what they're talking about. And so they're grabbing for this and grabbing for that without going a little bit deep into what they're talking about. Yeah. So better to have high quality and less quantity if that's what it takes. But what you're getting is quantity. And it's like, hey, there's underground bunkers, you know, they don't understand COG. They don't understand the deep state. These are deep concepts from, you know, yourself, an Oxford scholar, Professor Scott, you know, I could name 100 others. And that work didn't come to them, you know, rolling out catchy clickbait headlines.
I wish they'd use the Bosley model. Friend Walter Bosley.
Yes.
Because when Walter doesn't have anything to talk about and he wants to do a podcast, what does he do? He reads sections of books.
Right.
On the air.
Yes. Which,
hey, great way to kill some time. You know? Yeah. Oh, wow. So and so said that. Well, cool. You know, It just, come on, people. And
since we mentioned Bosley, he's in your recent book, so that's
definitely he's in both of them.
That's a great Chris Cross. His Origins book, I think, plays directly.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great book. That is my favorite book of his that he's done, and I like his Beerus exploration.
Yes.
But I love the Origins book because I think he's probably the only one that has really figured out the significance of those very, very strange Delshaw paintings. I've got two copies of that book of Delshaw paintings, and it was Walter that put me onto it. They are just very bizarre. There's no two ways about them.
Of course, one of them says with an arrow, Trump, and then 45. Yep. That's very strange. There's a predictive quality to them. There's a
predictive quality to it. And, you know, Walter and I spent a long time decoding. There's actually an equation in most of those paintings.
Yes.
There is an equation. Yep. And, you know, I did a little thing for him years ago on what I thought it may have been. You know, I came.
Oh, interesting.
Three different possibilities. Oh, yeah. It's.
Oh, I'd like to go over that with you. That's because there's the DMC.
Yes.
Equals X.
The equation is a delta, if I remember correctly, and then it has three lines, which is an absolute equality in mathematics, and then dx or something like that. But the delta is very clear. That's a system state change. It's a change. Means a change. So yes. there's something going on with that that I'd have to, if I still can find my notes about it, I'll send them to you. I don't know.
So a change in the medium that makes it.
There's some sort of change, and it's absolutely identical to x and something else. I don't remember what it is, but I did come up with three different possibilities for it that I put in a little memo to Walter. He may still have it. I don't know.
Oh, fascinating. All right. Yeah. I would love to see that.
Yeah. If I can find.
I've been wondering about those. Yeah.
Oh, it's very strange. He was definitely painting something. And here's another connection for you. Do you know who collected a lot of Delshaw paintings?
There's a JFK connection.
Yes.
DeMille. Yes. It's Jean DeMille. Yes.
DeMille. Yeah.
Unbelievable. What does that tell you? As a matter of fact, they were some of the first to put them out to the public.
Yep they were. Yeah. It's just bizarre. It's just totally bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's high just, five to George de Morenschild because they were.
Yep.
It's interesting because Garrison spent so much time on them.
Oh, he did. Yes, he did.
Yeah,
he knew something was up there.
Yeah,
I don't think he ever figured that whole de Morenschild, de Manil, Oswald connection out.
Yeah,
but I think it was because he was not expecting to number one the ecclesiastical connections that he saw there, which is a part of the story that no one wants to touch.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a story there. It's that footnote on page 253 in LBJ.
Of your book.
Uh-huh.
LBJ and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy.
I knew one of those individuals very, very well.
Incredible. Yeah. You know, that aspect shows up in odd little ways.
Oh, it sure does.
I'll tell you the weirdest of the whole thing, which is there's a serial killer who's writing letters to an Australian television woman, and he tells her of his adventure of picking up a hitchhiking Lee Harvey Oswald.
Oh, wow.
And he said that Oswald, after he dropped him off, he got the impression that he was heading over the border to Mexico with a priest.
Oh, that wouldn't surprise me. Yeah.
So
I bet you I could take a pretty good guess as to who the priest might have been, too.
Wow.
And what was going on. But that's...
Joseph, absolutely fascinating. And I don't think we'll ever look at the Civil War the same way again.
I hope not. No, I mean, I'm very serious. You know, it was bad enough that this country fought that war.
Yeah.
Still our bloodiest war to date, if you can believe that.
Wow.
Which, you know, I don't know if you have ever been to a Civil War battlefield, but when I was about 9 years old, we took a trip to Washington, D.C. My dad's brother had just become the budget director at the Smithsonian, believe it or not. And
there's a job.
That's a job. Yeah, my uncle's name was Robert Lee Farrell. Yeah, my grandmother, my French Bonapartist Confederate grandmother.
That's almost like Jefferson Davis Tippett.
Yeah, that's like Jefferson Davis Tippett, exactly. So one day we drove out to the battlefield of First Bull Run, First Manassas Battlefield, and we toured around there. And I've got to tell you, when you see the battlefield and, you know, the cannons lined up facing each other, and it's a creepy experience. There are ghosts on those battlefields.
Oh, wow.
You know, when you look at what they were doing, it's just a very creepy thing. And it was such in the final analysis, all wars are unnecessary, but that one to me is always, and it's interesting that many people have commented that war, even more than the American Revolution itself, has most impacted the modern American psyche. We think of that war more than we do our own revolution. And it's true.
Oh, yes. Yes.
The name.
It's extraordinary. The parallel that's coming up now.
Yeah.
And it's almost a demand for civil war, right? You have to take aside.
I think it's because everybody senses the country is at that crossroads again.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in a way that it was not even in 1860 and 61, because we now have a totally off the wall, bonkers, radicalized political party in one political party, and the other political party is, you know, what? We don't really know anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the country is very badly divided. The country is. One branch of government is at war with another branch of government in a way that we've never really seen. We have whole states that I'm all in favor of my idea of reverse secession. You know, if you want to run things that way, out you go, you know, go
right.
Be on your own. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Have our blessing and just go.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen the country so badly divided. And the last one was very bad. And then patching it up was even worse, made things even worse. Because they never really got patched up. That's the problem.
No question. Mm-hmm. No question. And there's still a mystery lingering there about Lincoln. I mean, you know, I'm glad that you tackled this because it's interesting. Professor Scott told me that if he had one regret, it was that he never tackled the Lincoln deep state assassination aspect. Well, now.
And to his credit, and in fact, it's Professor Scott, I believe, that was the first one, and I mention him in the books. I think it was Professor Scott that actually came up with the idea that Jefferson Davis's flight from Richmond in 1865 was a continuity of government operation, which if you know the details, it certainly was.
Wow.
There's not, again, it was not the fanatical, stubborn Southern leader wanting to, you know, carry on the cause. And No. It was a carefully calculated continuity of government operation. It failed. But there were too many aspects of it that were carefully calculated, and I go into that in those aspects in both books.
Fantastic.
You know, the last person in the world that was a fanatic was Jefferson Davis. I mean, you know,
yeah,
that's one thing he was not. But
yeah, what an incredible missing chapter in all of history.
Totally. You know, and again, deep state involvement with Lincoln's assassination, you betcha. Oh, huge. Yeah. Huge. There's no
truth. Yeah, it's about the same. It. Yeah, it's that same thing. It's a compelling reason. Yep. It's the same superstructure calling the shots.
Yep.
And when it comes around 100 years later, it's almost a weird, eerie echo in the Kennedy era. You know,
absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. All of the major things are there, and that's what's so disturbing about it. And now we're heading back into that cultural political cycle that we've encountered before in the history of this country, and it bothers me. It bothers me a lot. I think we've been in our own updated version of the Civil War for a long time, and you know now it's breaking out into the open again.
Right. Well, what's fascinating about that is Civil War with a golden dome, right? Where does that take you? I mean, the technology is involved at a level it could never have been envisioned.
The technology is involved. And then, as I said earlier, all the neuro-linguistic program going on with the word gold.
Gold.
Why?
Golden era.
Yeah, the golden era, the golden age. Yep. It's a trap. Wow. It's a trap, and I'm trying to warn people, don't buy into it. Just don't let them do it.
Wow, absolutely fascinating. Joseph, where do people get these books?
If you're talking about the Civil War books, Adventures Unlimited is the new one just came out. So if you're ordering on Amazon, it's going to take forever to get it. Okay. So go directly to Adventures Unlimited Press. Just go online and search for them. You'll get it much faster. They do take credit cards, checks, you know, whatever. But you'll get the books much faster than through Amazon. Uh-oh. Now my phone has decided to ring.
Incredible. And if someone goes to Giza Death Star, does it plug in there or not yet?
Yeah, it is plugged in on the website now.
Okay, good.
If you click on the two book covers, they should take you directly to Adventures Unlimited.
Okay, Press. That's where it's all heading. I see. Yeah.
If they don't, just go to Adventures Unlimited Press and look for it.
Well, I'm hooked on number one, and this one is just incredible. I can't wait for the follow up that's coming out. And how those fit together. But so many things are tied in there. We didn't even get into The Wizard of Oz, but we will next time.
Well, do me a favor. Just email me your mailing address, and I'll try and tuck a complimentary copy in the mail for you.
Yes. Yeah, that would be fantastic. Absolutely. Yeah. Off the charts. I have a feeling that the Roswell Reignited piece is going to crisscross with so much of your research in Roswell and the Reich as well. So,
who knows? It's definitely a story that's not going to go away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go away.
It's great to see you, sir.
Well, thank you. And for the people that want to know more about my Roswell thing, there's my Roswell and the Reich book, and also the McCarthy, Monmouth, and the Deep State book. That's also part of the Roswell story.
The McCarthy transcripts have Roswell in the questions.
Clearly.
Yeah.
The last person I expected to find connected to Roswell was Joseph McCarthy. But it's there, folks.
Like unbelievable. Wow. So all just right, absolutely sir. Fascinating.
Thank Talk you. Talk to you soon. Yeah, bye-bye.